Wretched Radio begins in 3, 2, 1.
So it's not a sin in your church to have an abortion?
That's the kind of conversation we would have, finding out your story, where you're from. God's the judge. People have to live to their own conviction.
The science is clear. The Bible is clear. And if we're honest, our intuitions are clear. We know what we're killing. We're killing a human being.
It's time for Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
Not to brag or anything, but I was just in Bethlehem. This is Wretched Radio. No, not in Israel, but in a Bethlehem-like city. You recall poor little Bethlehem, mocked. It was so puny. It was so backwater. It couldn't be imagined that the Messiah would come from a little lowly town like that. Even Jesus' brothers thought, you know, if you're going to make yourself a big deal, if you're really thinking you're the Messiah, you better get to Jerusalem because that's the epicenter and that's where big, important things happen. And yet, we have that same attitude today, don't we? You see, I was actually just in Fargo, North Dakota.
Oh, that's your Bethlehem?
Well, most people would think it is. It's Fargo, North Dakota. There was a movie made about it, and of course we now assume that everybody must talk just like that, eh? And actually, a lot of them do, come to think of it. There actually is a North Dakota accent. There is a Fargo, Minnesota sort of thing that does happen. Nevertheless, most people, when they think about a town like Fargo, they would think flyover country. They would think, well, it's not an important place like New York City, Los Angeles. And we have the same attitude, it seems to me, about smaller towns that is nothing new because there ain't nothing new under the sun. And yet, I learned a lot in Fargo, North Dakota. Wouldn't make a law out about this, but you would know this, gentlemen. Fargo would actually make fun of where you come from.
It absolutely would.
Because where y'all come from is Tinyville.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. Yep. Now, you live in Atlanta, Mike and Jimmy.
Yep. Yes.
Notice a difference?
Oh, yeah.
Traffic.
Okay, traffic. Traffic is a good example of pace of life. It's probably more emblematic of, I think, lifestyle choices than we realize. We flew into the Twin Cities, rented a car, and we got a pickup truck. I don't want to say that I like the Ford F-150 better than the Chevy, but I'm just saying. We rented this pickup truck, and we were immediately getting annoyed with pretty much everybody. Why aren't they going faster? What's the matter with these people? They're doing 55. Who does 55 on the freeway? You see, in Atlanta, the joke is you do 85 on Highway 85, but it's not a joke.
No. It's not.
You do it or you get rammed.
It's quite dangerous.
From behind. You just got to go, man.
I'm trying to imagine you in a pickup truck.
It works. Just trust me on this. It
with
works.
The country blaring.
It would. Let's not get carried away. The intensity of the driving is palpable. I forced myself to just slow down because I thought, all right, I'm either going to have a stroke because everybody in Minnesota drives too slowly, or I can slow myself down. And I have a confession to make. It made a difference. Instead of, that's the message. You got to get there. You got to hurry up. You got to gun it because you got places to be. Just slowing down a little bit. And just breathing a little bit, it was kind of nice, quite honestly.
It's changed me being here because I used to be very generous about letting people come into the lane or, hey, if you're trying to get
no
in
mas.
Where you can. No, it's like, nope, you're going to have to wait.
See, and that is what happens when you live in a major city. The question, of course, is does the Bible tell us which is better? And the answer is no. I just can't think of a Bible verse that says it's bad to live in a big city where the traffic is bonkers or where the intensity of life is at 78 speed. There's nothing in the Bible that indicates one is better than the other. And yet, I would still suggest to you there is a lot that we can learn from a smaller town. How is our life calibrated? We are to be Christians who work hard. All too often, I think, in Christian ministry and even in Christian churches, it can be a safe harbor for lazy people. We don't have to work as hard, we think, because, well, people will forgive us if we're late with, fill in the blank. I don't think that should be the answer, or that should be the attitude of the Christian. We should be the best worker. We should be the most productive people. And yet, I wonder if some of us might need to consider our pace of life, and is it the best way for us to grow in our relationship with God and with one another? If you live in a big city, ask yourself the question, do you ever just chill with folks? I'll bet it's not a lot. And if you live in a small town, do you perhaps think, the last thing I want to do is chill with people? That's all we do around here is chill with people. And I want to get to a place where it's happening, daddy-o. Maybe. And I think it's a preferential choice. But I think to do, make that decision without thinking through some quality of life issues, how it will affect not just our blood pressure, but how it will affect our maturity, our growth, our ability to serve in the local church, are questions that we would do well to answer. I started asking them, to be quite honest. How is the zip code that you're living in affecting your walk? I suspect it is. Do you feel like you've got to get out of bed in the morning and just get on it, daddy-o? You got to get there. You better, because if I'm 5 minutes late into traffic, I'm going to be an extra half hour in traffic. Now, yep. I know maybe that sounds silly to you in Atlanta. That's a real thing.
If you
miss it, you're just, forget it. You can count on spending more time in traffic. Now, all of those things are going to squeeze you. They're going to press in on you. And I have to tell you, spending some time in Fargo, North Dakota, the fellowship, as always, with Christian brothers and sisters, sweet. It always is. No matter where you go, it always is sweet, is it not? And yet, there was an increased sense of, what's the hurry? Why do you need to rush off to do something? Why not just spend sweet time right here? There's a ditch you can fall into, which means, well, now we never have to be punctual. We never have to be on time. We never have to organize things. We can just kick it back and never produce anything. That's wrong also. But it caused me to at least ask some questions about balance and how anxious I might be about, well, virtually everything, which leads us to a subject that perhaps will hit home with you. How do you do at waiting?
I'm not good at waiting.
It's hard, especially when you live in a place like Atlanta, Georgia, which isn't Georgia. I think they should just call it Atlanta, USA, because it's really not Georgia. You drive outside of Atlanta, it's a different place. But here, it's just this pressure cooker. You maybe feel that all the time, and waiting, just stopping, thinking, praying, not figuring out a way to get things done is exceedingly difficult for you, especially in an era of social media where you can just change to the next thing that doesn't. I'm not amused. I'm not entertained. Next, 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 next. It plays a role in how you and I go about the business of doing something biblical. For your consideration, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 verses on waiting. Let me share all 6 with you. Click, 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 click. Did you hear the dials turning? I don't have time for 6 verses on waiting. Just give me 1. I'll get the point, which is exactly perhaps the point. And maybe, just maybe, the pressure cooker that we live in, all of us, I don't care if you're in Fargo or Atlanta or New York City, we all, to a degree, feel contemporary 21st century urgency. And maybe that is causing you to be a little bit frustrated with God because you're waiting, perhaps, to be married, and yet there are no suitable spouses on the horizon. Maybe you're waiting to have a baby, and God has not opened the womb yet. Maybe you're stuck in a job you hate and waiting for a better offer. Maybe, just maybe, you struggle with anxiety and you're waiting for joy and you're getting angry because it ain't coming as fast as you want it to. you're sick, and you would just like a good day. And God has you waiting. Are you struggling? Consider some of these verses. The Lord is good to those who wait for him, to the soul who seeks him. Wait for the Lord. Be strong. Let your heart take courage. Wait for the Lord. But they all who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles, run and not be weary. They shall walk and not grow faint. Be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him. Fret not yourself over the one who prospers in this way, over the man who carries out evil devices. I wait for the Lord. My soul waits, and in his word I hope. My soul waits for the Lord more than watchmen in the morning, more than watchmen in the morning. In other words, exclamation point. But as for me, I watch and hope for the Lord. I wait for God, my Savior. My God will hear me. Are you waiting well? If not, these verses, if you were able to wait to hear all six of them, have promises for you that can turn your frustrated waiting into waiting that actually has joy. Whilst you're waiting, would you like some of that? We will discuss how to get it next on Wretched Radio.
Imagine, it's Sunday morning. The alarm clock rings. Bring. Sorry, we got a budget. We don't have much for sound effects here. Bring. The alarm bell goes off. You jump out of bed, excited to get ready for a day at church. You put your little gaggle into the minivan. You arrive at church. You greet everybody happily. You sit down, but wait. There's no pastor. That is what it is like for thousands and thousands of Christians in thousands of churches. They have buildings, they have pulpits, and no shepherds to fill them. We can change that by supporting the Master's Academy International mini seminaries around the globe. Visit wretched.org/pastor. Pick your favorite country and adopt a seminary, and let's fill pulpits together. wretched.org/pastor.
Hey, thank you so much for listening in to Wretched Radio today. We are certainly appreciative of your time and definitely don't take it for granted. You know, Halloween just around the corner, and that means it's time to break out the Snickers bar, the Butterfingers, the candy bowls, and the gospel tracks. That's right, the gospel tracks. This year, give the kids the gospel with the booklet Don't Stub Your Toe. And it's super easy to do. When kids come to your door, give them candy and Don't Stub Your Toe for them to read and bring home to their parents. Don't Stub Your Toe is the perfect booklet to give away to anyone in need of hearing the gospel. It's a thorough presentation of the good news that absolutely anybody can understand. The mission field is literally coming to your doorstep this Halloween, so don't pass up on this opportunity to give the gospel with Don't Stub Your Toe. Just visit wretched.org/toe to get your copies to give away. That's wretched.org/toe. Wretched. Amazing grace. Amazing gospel.
Ultrasound machines save lives. Don't believe me? Then believe Dan Steiner of preborn.org.
A young woman come in, 18, with her boyfriend, and he's pushing her to abort, took her back into the ultrasound room. There's two hearts here. It's twins. The father looks at that, this 19-year-old guy. He goes, I don't know what we're going to do, but I know what we're not going to do. We're not going to kill those two babies.
Ultrasounds work. When a mommy, a daddy sees a picture of their baby in the womb, 80% of the time they choose life. It is $28 per ultrasound. May I ask, how many ultrasounds could you provide? $28 per month. Please note, whilst Preborn is busy trying to save the lives of babies, they're trying to save the souls of mommies and daddies by preaching the gospel. Please consider supporting Preborn at preborn.org/wretched, preborn.org/wretched.
Revelation. How can anyone know God unless he reveals himself? If God did not speak, religion would be nothing more than man's best guess. But God has revealed himself in creation, in the Bible, and in the person of Jesus Christ. We can know God, and we can be brought into right standing with him.
This is Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
Don't want to brag, but I was just in Fargo, North Dakota, and it was good. This is Wretched Radio. Something to be said for a slower pace of life. And yet, even if you live in a tiny town where things don't happen lickety-split, you and I can struggle to wait for what it is that we want, for what it is that we perceive we need, for our timetable, our schedule, based on our demands and our desires. It is hard to wait. And the reality is, I don't care how many people live in your hometown, how busy or busy it isn't, waiting is a challenge for all of us. Do you do it well? Do you even ponder it? Or do you just get frustrated like I do?
Frustrated.
We don't stop and go, wait a second. God actually speaks about waiting a lot and that there is blessing in waiting well. And if we fail to recognize when we are not getting things our way on our time schedule and that we have to wait, that God is doing something. He's not going to do something. He is doing something in that waiting. You and I can become lemon drops, very, very sour, which, by the way, I have a full bag of, thanks to Candyland in St. Paul, Minnesota. It was open. Had to wear a mask to go in, but the caramel corn at Candyland.
You made the sacrifice.
It made the sacrifice. It was really, really good stuff.
So can I expect gifts today?
But the bag's open. He's probably
the bag's open. You can help yourself. Just make sure you put on one of those blue plastic gloves. No matter where you are, you have to wait. And you can get frustrated and anxious, and God doesn't want that for you. He wants you to actually get what he's trying to get out of you or into you in waiting. We have a tendency to think of Romans 8 and go, you know, God's working out all things. So, hey, this is really rotten, but just, you'll just see, he's going to make lemonade out of lemon drops. Oops, I'm sorry. I brought it up again, Jimmy. That was my bad. I wasn't trying to rub anything in.
You didn't do that on purpose.
The caramel corn was warm when I got it. I'm just saying. I finished a number four with butter by myself. Two sittings. That was not a good decision.
Well, you just went to the dentist, so you're good.
Nevertheless, I did just go to the dentist. And you have to wait there, too. How do you do in a waiting room?
I'm thinking most people, what constitutes waiting? Because more than a few minutes and people are already frustrated.
Yeah, but I'm talking about bigger stuff. I'm not just talking about sitting in traffic and having to wait for the light to change, although that's probably a fruit to indicate your life is maybe just wound a little bit too tight. Nevertheless, when we have to wait for the big stuff, the longings of our hearts, the life issues, I'm waiting for my kids to be better behaved. I'm waiting for my kid to get through this phase. Once they get to that phase, then we're going to have a happy home. Once I get this job, then I'll be happy.
Yeah, let's talk about jobs, because I had to wait for this job an awful long time.
And how'd you do, Jimmy?
Not very well. You can ask Mike. He was my counselor.
Let us, therefore, wow. Job had those too. Let us take a look at an article, a courtesy of one who had to learn how to wait. This is something that none of us do very, very well. This is from, where's my glasses? For the Church is where it comes from. A number of verses that tell us to wait on the Lord. The Lord is good to those who wait for him. And that's probably the nastiest fruit of being a bad waiter. We don't think that God is being good. We think that God is being bad. Hurry up. And it's a good desire. There's nothing wrong with desiring, for instance, to have children. You haven't been able to have children and you want a child. That's not bad. It's okay. But you got to wait, and maybe you're growing bitter. Waiting is the hardest work of hope. But God has something to do, something to achieve in our waiting. Therefore, waiting means cooperating with the process of growth. God isn't going to make lemonade out of lemon drops. You can't really do that. But the point is, it's not going to get good. It actually is good. The waiting is good. because God is doing something in it. The process itself is a good thing. It's not just the outcome. All right, I'll endure this season. I'll grind it out. But then, wah and la, the job is going to, the offer is going to happen. No, 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 no. He's working it out for your good. The thing is good that you are waiting for. That waiting period is a working on you. Consider James chapter 5. And for those of you who are in Fargo, this might be a little bit more poignant because it's a farming illustration. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it until it receives the early and late rains. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. A lot to be said, but a farmer has got to be a patient waiter. But the farmer also knows something that you and I forget, that James wants to remind us of. He can put the seeds in the soil and then look out and go, come on, corn, where's the corn? I need the corn. Why isn't the corn happening? And he can get bitter, but he's a patient waiter. Why? Because he knows that there's work going on underneath the dirt. He can't see that work. He can't feel it, but it's happening. And the same thing is true with you. You are waiting for something. God is doing something in you. You might not even perceive it. He is doing something for you. Nothing happens to us that doesn't impact us to some degree. It can be a very minor amount, but it can be something major also. And even though you don't sense that it's happening, it is. And God is at work in you. And that should cause you to go, okay, I can wait. He's actually doing something in this that is something better than what I'm begging him for. Think about sovereignty for a moment. You want a child. And God is at this moment saying no. Now, he might forever say no. Nevertheless, right now he's saying no. While that is happening, let's say that he is going to determine next March 15th, the Ides of March, you're going to discover that you're pregnant. Until then, he's doing something for you that's actually more important than you being pregnant. How do I know? Because you're not pregnant. And God is intimately working in your life to do something. To do what? To conform you into the image of his son. So you and I might be thinking, I want a baby. I want a baby. I want to be married. I want a new job. I want to be. Have a good health day. God's response to you would be, I'm doing something more important right now. Your understanding of what is important is not in alignment with mine. I'm doing the thing that needs to be done for your betterment and for my glory. Now, does that help a little bit? It should. Waiting is also about letting go of control. Maybe that's your issue. Maybe God has you on hold. He's put you in park because you think that you are the driver of the automobile of your life. Which, if you're going to have an automobile for your life, pick the F-150. Because the Ford, I'm just telling you, it's just a sweeter ride than the Chevy.
Amen.
That is what God could be doing. Pulling you out of the driver's seat. And he's helping you to understand you're not in control. And you could be learning how to cooperate with what God is seeking to do rather than just kicking against the goads. There are other things that God seeks to achieve that are beyond you. Brace yourself for this one. God has more on his mind than just you or me. Don't forget, he's running a universe. And you and I, we are beloved pawns, but we are nevertheless, we're just the little players on the chess table, and he's doing other things. He also has things to achieve in others in our world. So maybe he's using your waiting or your circumstances as a way of helping, comforting, or encouraging another. Or maybe even bringing somebody to faith. Does that help a little bit? God is working during your waiting. We are not waiting to get something good. This thing is good. We are obeying God as we wait well. Find satisfaction in that obedience. How's about this? Rather than complaining about the waiting, praise God for the waiting. That's different, isn't it? And I'm telling you, something will happen to your soul. You will be more settled. You'll be less anxious. You will actually have more joy. People and circumstances don't make you impatient. They reveal that you are impatient. Maybe God is trying to teach us that one thing we don't like to admit, that we want to be in control. Being anxious is a way of saying, God, I think you're in the wrong chair. I should be sitting there. Eeks. So it's a sin to not wait well, too. Does that mean you can't lament? Nope. Does that mean you can't mourn because you're not getting a chance? Nope, it doesn't mean that. But it does mean that you are running to him for your comfort. You're running to him for your solace, and you're not banging on his door in fury. Why don't you give this to me now? The answer is because this is something that is better for you. Maybe he's trying to reveal impatience. Maybe part of the reason for waiting is to make us the person he wants us to be and build us fruit that represents the Holy Spirit's presence within us. Let's see if we can remember the list. Love, joy, peace, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. No, that's only eight. Oh, I forgot one. Patience. This is Wretched Radio.
An apostle is a messenger sent from God. The apostles were granted power and authority to establish the New Testament church. There are no apostles living today, but just as the early church dedicated themselves to the apostles' teachings, so we dedicate ourselves to their teachings, which have been recorded in the New Testament. This is Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
Don't mind telling you, I was at the most unusual church on Sunday in, of all places, Fargo, North Dakota. This is Wretched Radio. Question, what does your church say? That's right. What does your church communicate? It does, don't you know? Every piece of art does, and a building is no less a piece of art than a Renoir painting is.
What?
Renoir painting.
Okay.
Any piece of art says something. Now, it might not say much, but it's speaking something. Even when it doesn't say much, it's saying a lot by not saying much. Everything speaks. Design says something. It communicates something. That's why you either love or you loathe IKEA. That is a design, and it's thematic. It's very Scandahoovian.
That's what I was going to say, Scandahoovian.
Which, by the way, is very Lutheran. That's right. Martin Luther had an impact on IKEA. Oh.
That's not something he probably wants attributed to his legacy.
Well, it actually is. Now, I don't think the designers of Scandinavian like furniture are sitting there singing "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God," but they were influenced by Martin Luther. Martin Luther introduced Christian frugality, good stewardship, and not being frivolous in spending and in design, like the Roman Catholic Church was in their ornate buildings. He thought simplicity was better, and because the Scandinavian countries became predominantly Lutheran, I think most people there are, well, they're not, but they are by virtue of they got baptized into the church, or as a citizen, you're just a member of the church. Nevertheless, furniture design says something. That's why you don't, when you buy something in your house, you no doubt have said, well, that doesn't quite match the rest of the stuff. Why? Because it all speaks. It speaks of an era. It speaks of a design. It maybe even speaks of how things work and function and laws and properties, how it's designed to stand, how it operates, all speak. And that is the same thing for your church. Question, what does your church speak? You know, they used to think about this, and that is why the church that I went to on Sunday in Fargo, North Dakota was unusual, because it actually did something that we Christians used to take the time to do. And that is, what does the design of this church building say? How does it represent our theology? Ask a question. If you've been involved in a building project, did you ask those questions about your church? How does this church represent our theology? Because it does. When we visited Ulrich Zwingli's church in Zurich, Switzerland, the door to get into the place is massive. I mean, this thing, without exaggerating, probably 15 feet tall. Two doors that swang together. And it had this big round metal knob on it that you had to pull. And I mean, you had to pull to get this bad boy open. Was that because they just had a lot of extra wood lying around? No, there were a couple of reasons they built big, heavy doors. One, they wanted to put the gospel on it. On Zwingli's church door in Zurich, there's the gospel. There's motifs, square motifs, maybe four on each level, and it tells the story of the creation. Then we see Adam and Eve with their little fig leaves on, and then we see the serpent. It tells the story of creation, the fall. It tells the stories through the Old Testament, Jesus in a manger, the cross. You get the whole gospel by looking at the door. Seriously. Have any of us even thought about things like that? Would I make it a law that your church door needs to be big and heavy and it needs to have the gospel on it? No. But I would ask, why are we thinking about this stuff? The church door was also heavy because it wanted to remind the person who was headed into the sanctuary, you ain't all that. You are puny. You are weak. You struggled to get this door open. And then when you walked into something we used to call the sanctuary, most of us know that is the multipurpose facility, you felt small. Why? Because it was big. There were soaring ceilings. Furthermore, you couldn't see everything up there. There were parts intentionally designed for you to not know what's over there, what's back there. Why? Because it speaks about God, that he's bigger than we are. And that while we can know him in part, we cannot know him fully yet. We're going to spend eternity doing that and we'll never get to that end. These people put thought into it. Would I say that it's a sin to have a multi-purpose facility and not a sanctuary dedicated to, say, 90 minutes a week? No. But why did we jettison that? Why did we think no thought went into these structures? Why do we think that they don't say something to the visitor? We know they do. Come on, every church, I don't care who it is. Hey, we got to have this place cleaned up before visitors come. We might have some guests on Sunday, so we want to make sure that we have everything in order. We know that these things speak. You got a messy foyer, it sends a message. You've got a nice and tidy one. What style is the furniture? Church committees do this all the time. You know, we haven't had the carpet replaced since Bon Jovi had their last top 10 hit. We got to get this stuff because people, man, they're just going to think that we are fuddy-duddy. We're out of step.
Well, and they think that's why people aren't coming to church.
It could also, true, but we all get it. So my question for you is, what does your church say? Starting with the sanctuary. Does it say that Sunday morning worship is so important that we have spent a lot of time, energy, and money so that this building can only be used for an hour and a half a week? That's it. That's its only purpose. It's Sunday morning worship. All of this is worth it because it says God's assembling of God's people is super important.
Yeah, you're teaching me something here because I've never really thought about that from that perspective, because being a part of a building committee before, it was how can we maximize this space for multiple purposes?
And I don't think those are wrong questions, and I don't think those are sinful questions. I'm just saying we used to ask different questions.
Right.
That's all. What are we communicating with this? There's a book that has been written on the subject, In Christ and Architecture. Donald J. Brugink and Karl Droppers. When the Reformation happened, a lot of church reforming took place. Why? Because the Protestants, well, they inherited a lot of really big buildings and they went about changing them. Quote, wherever the Reformation went, the statues of Mary and the saints were torn down. Not for reasons of style, but because they were a temptation to idolatry. Not only in Switzerland, Germany, and the Low Countries, but throughout England, the stone altars in the churches were dismantled. Why not just leave? They're pretty. That was really expensive. Great craftsmanship. No, they're saying something that we don't want it to say. So what were they thinking? These things spoke too forcefully of the sacrifice of the Mass and obscured the finished work of Christ. So throughout Europe, In little tiny churches and great big cathedrals, the use made of the various parts of the church underwent radical change, not because of style preference, but because of renewed emphasis on the gospel. That's right. They actually believed that there were things in the church that spoke about the gospel. For instance, let's just say you have a communion table of some sort. Most churches don't these days. Why? Because it gets passed around. But there used to be a communion table of sorts. It could be an actual table, or it could be a railing or an altar. Now, where that thing is placed says something, doesn't it? What does it say if it's far away, that God is far away? What does it say if the baptismal font, and I get it, this is a trick, and the church that I attended in Fargo wrestled with this, they actually brought the baptismal font near the people. Why? Because they wanted to communicate God's means of grace, God's means of growing, the church activities, the ordinances of the church represent his nearness to his people. They speak. Have you ever pondered it to that detail? From the book, it might fairly be said that the Word of God challenged the architecture of medieval Romanism, and the Reformed responded with an attempt to transform these inherited buildings into structures more suitable for biblical worship. Yikes. Now, here's what we need to remember. There are no sacred spaces today. What? I thought that's why they called it a sanctuary. Well, the only thing that is holy is what God says that's holy. Nevertheless, that doesn't mean we can't consecrate. We can set aside a space for a particular activity. But in and of itself, it's not a holy thing. However, when you and I go about the business of designing a church, how's about whether we have pews or chairs? How's about the location of the pulpit? How's about the sound in the building? That's right, the acoustics of the building are saying something. How's about whether you step down into, step up into, or just walk straight into the sanctuary? Have you pondered any of these things in your church building? So I would ask again, what does your church building say? I'll tell you what the church in Fargo spoke next on Wretched Radio.
Hey, don't you just love how easy and how convenient texting is? Long phrases can be summed up in just a few letters, like LOL or TTYL or TTWW TTN44321, and you've got BRB and TY and YW. Wait, are you confused about one of those? Well, BRB means be right back. Oh, you mean the other one, the longer one. Well, for those of you not up to date on the Gen Z lingo, TTWW TTN44321 means text the word wretched to the number 44321. That's right, it's never been easier to become a gospel partner. All you have to do is text the word wretched to the number 44321, and every dollar you give is carefully stewarded away. If you're already a gospel partner, we can't even begin to tell you how grateful we are to you and for you. And if you're not already a gospel partner, would you prayerfully consider becoming one? Because without our gospel partners, wretched would literally CTE. That ceased to exist in Gen Z. So go ahead and text the word wretched to the number 44321.
If you have been looking for a reason to sponsor your very own Tomorrow Club in Eastern Europe, perhaps this story from Max, the national director in Ukraine, will inspire you to visit tomorrowclubs.org/wretched.
Arsene, just 5 years old, escaped his home and came to the camp. His grandmother would not let him. She was cursing all Christians. His grandmother sadly passes away. So he kept coming. Not only that, he brought his parents and they repented. So this family gives the house where the grandmother used to live to the church. And that's where the Tomorrow Club meets.
And that story is not a one-off. Families getting saved constantly through the Tomorrow Clubs in Eastern Europe. Would you please consider supporting your own Tomorrow Club? 30 disciples, $30 per month. TomorrowClubs.org/wretched.
Well, fall time is here, and you know what that means. It's pumpkin spice season. That's right. Coffee, scented candles, chapstick, Oreos, you name it, you can probably find it in pumpkin spice. And we didn't want to be left out, so for a limited time only, you can become a pumpkin spice gospel partner. What does that mean? Well, it's like a normal gospel partner, but spicy? And pumpkin-y? What's with the 20 questions? The point is, we want you to become a gospel partner. And when you become a gospel partner, you're going to be helping Wretched spread the good news of the gospel to people all over the world. As a matter of fact, every dollar you give is carefully stewarded away. If you're already a gospel partner, we are extremely grateful to you and for you. We can't do what we do without you. And if you're not, would you prayerfully consider becoming one? To become a gospel partner, it's simple. It's easy. All you have to do is visit wretched.org/donate, or to make it even easier, you can text WRETCHED to the number 44321. That's WRETCHED.org/donate, or text the word WRETCHED to the number 44321.
Books of the Bible. The Book of Psalms is a collection of divinely inspired songs of praise for every season in life. There are songs of lament, thanksgiving, praise, celebration, and remembrance of God's mighty deeds. All to help us find our soul's delight in God in all circumstances. This is Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
If you had to write this book, could you? This is Wretched Radio. In my never-before-nicotine-stained fingers, I have a booklet titled A Theology of Church Architecture. Could you write that book? Could your church design committee write that book? What were the conversations that took place when you built that building, which speaks constantly? Every time somebody drives by your church, it is speaking something. There is a connection between form and function. How we build things, how we do things, says something about what we believe. There, you can't disjoint it. That is true even in, no, perhaps especially in worship. How we do worship, it is saying something even when it is not using words. And I'm not saying one or the other, but if you use a pipe organ, God's ordained instrument for Sunday church worship, versus guitars and drums. Now, one or the other isn't sinful. But they say something, don't they? Even if you think that all they say is one is stodgy and fuddy-duddy and the other one is cool, it's still saying something. Now, I believe that it's actually saying more. I believe that the organ is an otherly sounding instrument. It is not one that you tend to hear. Even if you happen to hear it in a pop song, that's a Hammond organ. I'm talking about a big old pipe organ. Why? Because it was a different sound. Why? Because when Christians got together, they were doing something different. This is a different kind of singing. This is singing about God, to God. And we want the music to sound like it is something different than what you can do if you go to the karaoke club, karaoke, to the place where you sing to the thing with the dealy bob. Do they still do those anymore?
I don't know. You want to do one now?
Nope. I do not. What does your church building say? When I was attending church, a community Baptist church in Fargo, North Dakota, I picked up a booklet. Perhaps this will inspire you to think about what it is that we think about when we think about our church. Consider this. I think this is poignant. The local church building, it's the place where some of the most ordinary, yet most sacred experiences in our lives occur. For example, the local church building may be the scene of your conversion to Christ. Maybe it's where you saw your kids make a profession of faith for the first time. Maybe you experienced baptisms. You certainly watched them, where we partake of the Lord's table together, as well as entering into holy matrimony and witnessing marriages of family and friends. In your church, you might say farewell to friends and loved ones at funeral services. It is where you pray, where you give your gifts to God, where you exercise your spiritual gifts, where you enjoy weekly fellowship. Whatever, just make sure we can use it for basketball. Okay, now that's not a consideration that you have to neglect. But wow, a lot of big stuff happens in church, doesn't it? When you stop and consider just how many of our life experiences are tied to the local church building, it's amazing. Shouldn't a place of such meaningful experiences in our journey to the celestial city be worthy of the meaning of those events? And as this particular church did that, they went through everything, asking, how does our theology drive our architecture? What are we trying to say to people who come on the inside, both Christian and visitors? What does it say to people on the outside? And so, for instance, they actually thought about acoustics. Can we hear ourselves when we sing? Can we hear others when they sing? When something is so thumping loud, you can't hear anybody else sing. That is that we're supposed to be singing so that we can all hear one another. Why? Because it reminds us it's not just Jesus and me, with all due respect to Glenn Campbell. It's not just Jesus and me. You know, it is Jesus and me, but it's Jesus and me and you and the people in the other pew. It's a together thing. Acoustics make a difference because it tells us something, even if it's not saying, when you can hear other people singing, you're reminded that you're in a family, that you are the bride of Christ. Nevertheless, that's what it's saying. And speaking of pews, is it possible that people who used to build pews and put them in a building have a couple of thoughts in mind? For instance, permanence? That this worship center, it is permanently fixed for this one feature. We don't use it as a multi-purpose facility. It's staying put. How do I know? Because the seating devices are drilled into the ground. They're not going anywhere. Furthermore, I'm speculating on this. What does a pew say? I'm not sitting by myself. A chair says that, doesn't it? This is my chair. You got to share a pew. And isn't that what Christianity is really all about? Furthermore, here's a feature that exists in this church in Fargo, kneelers. That's right. During prayer time, kneel down. Why would they put those old fuddy-duddy things there? How's about because, this happens to be a quote from Horton Davies concerning Puritan prayer, posture. That's right. They used to think about these things. When Isaac Watts wished to persuade the nonconformists of the 18th century to desist from their practice of sitting down at prayer, he assured his readers that there were three permissible attitudes for prayer warranted by the scriptures. Prostration, lay down on your face. Kneeling, standing. But no divine sanction for sitting. Do we think about that even today? All right, everybody. We stand for the worship music. Sit down for prayer time. Stand for worship. I don't know where that started, but nevertheless, that's what we do. That also speaks, by the way. It tells us that the worship is probably the most reverential thing that we're doing, is it? Do we even ask about this? Kneelers are a thing of the past. They aren't at this particular church that said, how does our theology inform our architecture? What about the pulpit? Does it get moved and shuffled off the stage? Is it a stage? Is it an altar area? What is it? Why is it there? That is the question. Are we even asking these questions? From the booklet, the pulpit should express the fixedness and the eternality of the Word of God. They had a huge pulpit in this church. I dug it. I dug it a lot. The prophet Isaiah writes in chapter 40, "The grass withers, the flower fades, but the Word of our God stands forever." When the pulpit is fixed, it says the preaching of God's word, it stands forever. Oh, come on, you're getting carried away. Okay, but wouldn't it be wise to at least ask the question? Doesn't it exhibit a little bit more thoughtfulness than just mere functionality?
Being hip.
Well, that's part of it, by the way. That's why so many pulpits are removed. They seem to be an impediment for people. You know, it keeps the pastor separated from the people. Well, actually, that's why they used to make big pulpits, so that he would be separate from the people, because this is God speaking to you through a man's mouth. And furthermore, the pulpit used to be really, really big so that the man was really, really small, because that communicated something way more important than the pastor is just one of us. This church considered light. How does it shine? Where does it shine? Because the motif of light and darkness in the Bible is huge. Out of the darkness, light. And so in this particular church, they actually had a window where you couldn't see the window, but you could see the light from it. Just this idea that shadows accentuates the typology, that the fuzzy pictures becoming clear, that good news comes out of darkness. By putting a window in the ceiling of the area behind the pulpit known as the apse, that's what they did. They wanted to communicate God's transcendence. He's bigger. He's mysterious to us.
I'm loving this.
They wanted to communicate transcendence. That God is bigger. So big higher ceilings makes you feel puny on purpose. And yet they wanted to communicate immanence. Martin Luther said, if you want to know where God is, go to where the Christians are. The building's design can aid in communicating to the believer what is theologically true. And so what? The communion table, it was near. The baptismal font, it was near. The size and the shape of the sanctuary assures that the congregation is sitting near the pulpit, the communion table, and the baptismal font, communicating God is near to us. Yep, he's transcendent, but he's also near to us. And finally, viewing the cross, that there is actually a cross in the building. Why? Why should the cross be the central piece of art in a church, even as a lot of megachurches take it out because they don't want it to communicate something bad? See, they recognize it communicates something. This church would say, make it big, make it prominent. Why? Because the cross is big and prominent. That's the purpose for the universe. Why wouldn't it be the central image that we have inside of a church? All that to say, a church speaks. It is saying something, and we don't want to make laws where there are no laws, even though I do believe it should be a law that the organ should only be used for worship on Sunday. Nevertheless, perhaps before you go about the business of designing your church, even for this Sunday, maybe asking some of these questions doesn't make us a fuddy-duddy, stodgy, old-fashioned. Maybe, just maybe, it actually makes us more biblical and more thoughtful. Until tomorrow, go serve your king.